Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, where book clubs aren't just for women, and we're going to take these beers to go and drink them on the road.
I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
I'm Jimmy.
And we're the Drunk Guys, and this week we are reading On the Road by Jack Kerouac. And Nate, starting with a beer.
My beer won so hard this month, this week, it's actually like boring. My beer is called Road Tripper. Boom. It's like so on the nose. It's actually boring. This is, and also the beer, kind of boring. It's an amber ale.
Beer.
6% alcohol. A Road Tripper by Crooked Stave. Tastes amber.
Ooh. Watch out for the mosquitoes in there. They make dinosaurs.
You know, I don't know if we ever said this, but when we made fun of that when we read Jurassic Park 8,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. But there were actually scientific articles published about that idea in like 1989 that Michael Crichton skimmed. Like, it was not just him making it up.
No, I'm sure it's... No. He's not the first.
You can't get DNA from those.
They didn't know that yet, though. People were like, I bet we could get DNA. And they were like, holy shit, that'd be really cool. And then he ran with it.
I don't know if this is true, but I'm going to say it because I don't care. I don't think he's ever had an original idea.
I think he just, when he put it together,
he
to
extrapolates
make Dinosaur Island.
Stuff from a Cliff Notes version of science.
That's fine.
Yeah. It's not bad. Yeah, he's not bad at it. But it is like, he's like, oh, I read the headline of something that sounded interesting. I'm going to write a book based on that. Like, you sure, Mike? You want to read the rest of it? See what it's like? No, I'm good.
It was better than Dark Matter because that book doesn't have dark matter.
Yes.
There was a park in Jurassic Park.
It does contain parks.
So it was based off of Highlights for Kids level of news. Anyway, we should talk about it On the Road. Jimmy, did you pick this? You had to pick this.
I did pick this. This is one of my picks.
I knew you did.
It's a classic that, you know, we're what, 7 or 8 years in? We should read it at some point.
No, it was on my list to read, and now it's off my list, and I'm happy. For that one reason.
Yes. This is, what was it, 1957 it came out, you know?
Yep.
It's one of the great American novels, though. I don't know. It's loosely a novel.
Why it's great beats me.
This is another one of those beat generation things like the electric salmon overload or whatever the fuck that book was called. Trout fishing in America.
You're thinking of the electric Kool-Aid Estes?
Yeah, I'm just combining. Oh, they're all gibberish fucking words. But it was like those guys that wrote shit in the 50s doing a lot of acid and, you know, countercultural shit. This was largely based, almost entirely really, on things he really did. Like, this was shit he did. This is him writing the adventures he had, driving around America with a bunch of weirdos, doing weird shit, mostly getting drunk and trying to bang ladies.
Did you say bang ladies?
Oh, yeah, he did. They try to bang ladies a lot.
They do, and they succeed. I mean, his main goal in the beginning is to find his friend Neil Cassady, who in my head I was thinking David Cassady from the Partridge Family the whole time.
Well, it's Neil Cassady, but in the book it's Dean Moriarty.
Moriarty.
Yeah.
And Jack Kerouac is a Guinea named Sal Paradise.
Famous Italian name, Paradise.
But, that hurt. We find, soon enough, Dean Moriarty especially, though, he is only interested in bangers when it comes to the ladies. And that is the name of this beer, which is a double IPA from the Hop Butcher. Yeah, hopbutcher.com.
I haven't had one of those in a while. Hop Butcher for the World?
I'm just reading Hop Butcher for the World in Chicago, Illinois. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an oddly long name. That's like Portugal the Man. Hop Butcher for the World.
Period. There's a period at the end of that, too.
It's all lowercase. This is great. It's got some of my favorite hops in there. And I'm only interested in this banger, too.
Well, I'm going to drink this because this is why I got this beer.
What did you think I did?
I mean, it's literally what we were just talking about.
Okay.
You know, it's his friend Neil, but in the book, he's named Dean Moriarty. Like, I'll tell you, this is the first time I've read this book like this. The first time I read the original scroll version, which is
hipster,
bigger, longer, and uncut. Literally, it's a there's no paragraphs. It's just run-ons, gibberish for hundreds of pages.
I've seen this book.
What the editors were like. You gotta no, man, no. And so they trimmed it down, gave it proper punctuation in paragraphs, and split it up, and you know, chapters and whatnot.
It was the scroll. It was literally a scroll. Like he, I don't know how.
Yeah, he was at
Michael's and got a long tube of paper or something. It was just like 23. It was like what the fuck was the jerk off book with turds in it? The French one. Yeah, where it's like one long sheet. It was literally one giant scroll. Like he was like reading some, you know, some announcement in 1740.
And the announcement was 12 hours long.
Yeah.
So yeah, I read that version first. This is my first time reading the version most people read. But they also, when they edited it down, it's like, you have to change all these people's names because this is weird and you can't tell the people did these things. And they also cut out a lot of like the objectively gay stuff. So this beer is called By Any Other Name, because you had to use any other name, but not the real ones.
And this, so you pick these names that sound very literary.
Yeah. Carlo Marx.
It reminded me of, Crying a Lot 49. We were like, this has to mean something, right?
Oh, they're very self-aware. Yeah.
Ooh. But okay. In Crying a Lot 49, they're like, there's a guy named like Frank Fallopian, and you're like, what the fuck is that guy's name? That's not a name. And you're like, Moriarty? Like Sherlock Holmes? What's
Dean
that doing there?
Moriarty. So he works at a school? this is a blueberry cider, or a cider with blueberries. I don't know if that's different. I guess that's different. From Artifact Cider Project. And it tastes like a cider with blueberries. And then Jack is like, cider? I barely know her. So
he'd like to get cider.
Yeah, he does spend a lot of time in this. When it starts off, Neil slash Dean in this book is already married, but that's not stopping him from going to town on everybody else.
Every woman in Denver
and in New York and San Francisco and Mexico and along the way.
The real journey were the women you banged along the way.
It's not about the destination. It's about the journey, which is really what the book is about. Yeah.
Good. Tell us what you thought.
Yeah. It's about, you know, banging on the road.
It's the precursor to the Beatles song, Why Don't We Do It in the Road? So it starts off, Sal is
living
looking
in New
for
York.
A change of pace.
Well, also an important thing that they did, they changed. I don't know why they made this change, but the book starts off with, like, I just, you know, started here after, right after my wife and I split up, I first heard about Dean. And you're like, okay, you know, he's what's up. But in the real one, it makes more sense because he talks about it later on in the book. Anyway, he's like, right after my father died. So, you know, he's a young guy. His dad just died. He's lost. And it's also, this is that lost generation shit where he'd like been in the war or he like was
yeah,
in the
he
army.
He goes to the GI Bill pays for his college at some point in the book.
Yeah. And so he gets back and, you know, we just nuked Japan, and I'm sure we discuss this every time we do a beat book or a 50s book, is like, you know, nothing meant anything anymore, and everybody's like, we're all going to die any second. This can't be the way we're supposed to live, and all this, you know, American lifestyle bullshit. So we got to try something different. So they decide to just be fucking, you know, bohemian hobo folks and drive around, get into adventures of not meaninglessness, because that the point of it is doing the thing. They have a very big overlap at this point with Buddhism, partly because it's the things they already believed, but also partly because they were trying to be countercultural. And it was like, you know, Christianity was America, America, ruhaha. And it was like, what if we did something different? Like, what's not American? Like, Asian stuff. So they picked one. It was partly that, partly, you know, it just made sense. And they did a lot of drugs. So it was very much like the whole American standard of living of, you know, consumerism, materialism, and the insanity of being on the brink of worldwide destruction. It's like, fuck it, let's just drink and party and like just go out and have experiences and not, you know, play it safe and get a job and buy a house and have a kid and die. And so this book is doing exactly that. So you could say there's no real point, but the point is doing the thing.
I will
thing.
Say that.
So so it's odd. It's an odd experience.
Well, they saw the best minds of their generation destroyed by madness. That's the Ginsberg poem, right?
So well, Ginsberg like, is Karl Marx in this.
You know what? If you look at what Allen Ginsberg looked like, you know, yeah, I could see it. So it's like, let's go hitchhike. And the other thing that I was thinking about throughout this is that the interstate highway system was not completed yet. So this hitchhiking must have sucked balls back then. I mean, it's not great now. You
it's
have to
probably
often
better
suck balls
back then because people actually picked you up.
Well, that's true. But like, it's like, all right, well, you got to go. Where do you want to go? That way? Oh, well, the only way to actually get there is to go 300 miles out of your way because there's no fucking road connecting things. Or you're going on a dirt path.
So in the beginning, yeah, so, okay. The book doesn't have a typical plot where it's like the people have objectives and they're trying to, defeat Voldemort and stuff like that. Instead, what's his name? Sal, also known as
Sal Jack. Goodman.
Yep, exactly. Is also known as Jack, and his friend is like trying to find Dean or meet up with Dean, or Dean comes to New York, and then they're like, let's go on a trip, or let's and Sal, also known as Jack Kerouac, is like, I want to go to San Francisco, but I don't have enough money, and I'm living with my aunt, so I'll just hitchhike, and it like both does not go well, but then he eventually gets there. In the very beginning, when I thought it would matter, it was like, oh yeah, so I hitchhiked north up the Hudson, and then it just rained a lot, and then I went back to New York. That was the whole thing. And then he goes back and forth between New York and San Francisco like three times?
Yeah, the book is like it's a series of like trips.
He's like Forrest Gump. He's like, I just felt like running, and he just keeps
but
going back
and
forth.
But only the running part, yeah. and just crazy stories about stuff along the way. And it's also about Dean and about how Dean just wants to fuck everything.
With his big pecker, he just got a. There's a part where they're like, yeah, she had drawn a picture of him, big penis and all. And you're like, oh, cool.
Yeah, he apparently did have a pretty rockin' dick.
I mean, good for him. The rest of his life was pretty shitty by all accounts. So you know, God evens it out somehow.
The real dude, Neil Cassady, like the book starts off with like he hadn't met them yet, or he'd heard about them, and he knows that the fucking names are so confusing. I'm just gonna call their real names.
That's going to confuse me.
Jack,
sure.
Jack slash Sal, the main character, is a writer. Not successful, really, by any means.
I am Jack's wanderlust.
I am Jack's complete lack of
complacency.
Jack's discontent.
Contentedness.
Neil shows up and he's like, teach me how to write because I want to be a writer too. And so he's like, all right, fine. We'll see what happens. But in real life, that's what it kind of was. Like Neil Cassady wanted to be a writer and knew Jack Kerouac was a writer. But like Neil never really ended up writing, except he wrote a lot of letters to all his weird, bohemian compatriots. And the way he wrote those letters kind of influenced the way Jack Kerouac wrote and all these other people wrote. And like the weird way he spoke in this book, like the way this book is written is based on how this weird guy talked to everybody. Like it's kind of like pseudo intellectual gibberish a lot of the time, but it sounds bizarre.
Because Neil Cassady was a fucking street urchin.
Yeah, he was like in and out of jail as a child all the time.
Really terrible childhood. Mother died when he was a kid. His dad was an alcoholic.
The worst kind, as they say, a wine alcoholic, which is just not respectable.
It's true. It's true, because like it cancels out. Like you have all the respectability of wine, which is supposed to be so cultured.
I was going to go the other way on that, but yeah, the respectability of alcoholism, but not for wine. Oh, you want another glass of sherry, bitch?
no thanks. So, but he had a really terrible, and I can't imagine. By all accounts, Neil Cassady was a very bright or brilliant guy, depending on who's talking. Like, he was a genius. But he didn't have an education. So, like, being a writer requires learning some fucking reading and shit. Like, you might be, you could have the greatest mind, but you can't transfer to the page. So, everybody, like, spoke to him, but he was smart.
in these circles, it seemed like intellectual, like being smart was not necessarily related to school, or like being a writer wasn't not, because the whole point is they were trying to like write like people spoke and not try and seem so forced. And in doing that, it kind of ends up seeming a little forced because it's kind of dated and no one talks like this anymore. Because
they use a lot of slang from the day, right?
There's a lot of slang. Sometimes you're like, what the fuck does that even mean?
Some of it is weird because it's like morphed, like when he's like, I'm really high. It's like he's drunk.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
People don't say that. I mean,
they say stoned when they mean drunk, too.
Yeah. Well, you know what? My parents will still say that occasionally, but like only when they're talking about something from 1974. Like that's what they called it then.
Like, it's non-transferable.
Really? Because like, that's how they remember it in their weird calcified drunk memories. But anyway, Neil Cassady, I looked at him because like, I was reading the Wikipedia page. I was like, am I supposed to fucking care who this guy is? And he's like, it's his friend based on Neil Cassady, Link. I'm like, oh, that's a person. And he did nothing in his life. He's just like this vest. He influenced them, but there's no concrete anything. Like, he didn't write anything that any normal person would read. You have to be like really be into the Beats to read Neil Cassady's letters or something like that.
So there were some really funny stories about how, like, I assume Jack Kerouac actually did all these things.
I think it's largely based on stuff he actually did. Yeah, these are the things that he did, and he wrote them all down and just changed the names.
And there are some funny things, like, partly, you know, pretty near at the beginning, he's, like, hitchhiked, and he's, like, sitting in the back of a truck with a bunch of other guys, and one of them is going to, like, pee off the truck bed, you know, while at speed, and then one guy, so he zips down his pants and he starts peeing, and somebody knocks on the window and they know what's going on. So they like swerve all over the road, and then the guy like falls back into the truck and then pees all over himself. And then afterward, he's like, oh, wait, did they do that on purpose?
Yes, they did.
That's what the Minnesotan guys, right?
Yeah, the guys who made all their money driving to L.A. to pick up farm equipment and then driving it back to Minnesota to sell. These are the days where like people are like, I'm just going to drive 3,000 miles.
Man, Amazon makes that free. So much easier.
Also,
but yeah, gas was cheap.
Everybody in this book was on fucking amphetamines almost the entire time.
Oh, yeah, because they I mean, there's parts where he's like, I just decided I wouldn't sleep.
He was like, I had three rolls of Benzedrine. It's like, I don't even know what a roll of Benzedrine is, but that's too much Benzedrine. Which doesn't exist anymore, but it's speed.
Is that the thing they gave the Nazis?
Yeah, pretty much. It's amphetamines.
That made them hallucinate after a while? They're like, even the Nazis are like, chill out, man. This is not cool.
This is too much Blitz.
Getting blitzed. See, there's like fun episodes, but basically the book is divided into five parts. And part one is he goes to...
Each part is a trip. There,
on the road, or there and back again. Where he goes to
about
Denver.
Second Benzedrine?
And then he finds Dean. That's the main thing. He's like, I gotta find Dean. And then he, like, because they're fucking hobo drifters, they have to pick up weird jobs. And there's a fun little section where he gets a job as like a military police officer,
night
or something.
Guard at a merchant marine barracks. So like sailors come and spend the night when they're at port.
And he's like, port, I'd drink some. But then
this was the fun times when you could like walk into his like, I need a job. And they'd be like, sure, fine. You can be a police officer.
You're not like, black, are you? He's like, that's basically the standard.
You can't do this anymore because you need like getting a job is hard. There you just walk in. It's like, I am a white, able-bodied individual. I was like, sure. Do you want to marry my daughter too? I was like, no, I'm good on that.
So, I mean, there's just funny adventures where they're just stealing the food from the, what the fuck is the word for it? The mess
canteen.
Hall.
Canteen.
Canteen, yeah. And is the French guy, Remy.
His childhood friend.
Betancourt or something like that was his name.
They're all fake anyway.
Boncour? How do you pronounce that word?
Delancour, was it?
Boncour. It's all vowels. It's a terrible word.
It's all vowels.
Boncour, Goodhart.
Yeah, Goodhart. I mean, it's like, ah, subtle. But then they just keep stealing things, and eventually they get to the point where they're trying to take a giant box of groceries out of the mess hall, but it can't fit through the window. So they're like, ah, fuck it. We'll just leave it. Like, they're just shitty criminals and no one cares about anything.
And he has to tell all the people, all the sailors who are getting shit-faced in their barracks to, like, quiet down because they're in, like, a neighborhood that people are complaining. And he goes to each of the barracks and is like, hey, you guys got to calm down. I was like, hey, sorry about that. You want a shot? So he keeps doing a shot at every one of them until he's also shit-faced.
Yeah. And the Remy guy is obsessed with stealing things. So he keeps trying every single locked door to see if it's open so he could steal shit from it. And then they open one and there's the commanding officer guy's like, what the fuck are you doing? And he's like, I thought this was where the mops were. It's just funny episodes. But after 50, 60 pages, it's like, where is this going? Where does this road, titular road, go?
It doesn't go anywhere. The road is.
The road abides. And then eventually, though, They meet up with Dean, who's like, I have a wife, but I don't like her. I have a new girlfriend. I fuck everything.
And well, he has a girlfriend he keeps in a hotel across town, and he just bounces back.
So he has his wife in one hotel, and then he has his girlfriend in another hotel, and he like sees both of them every day.
Every time they hang out, Sal is like, what about me? He's like, oh yeah, I got some floozy. Go fuck this girl. And she's like, all right, yeah.
The 40s were a wild time.
Yeah, you don't really think of it. You know, you think of these, the greatest generation for a reason. They were just fucking banging relentlessly.
This was definitely a distinct minority of people back then, but they existed. But yeah, you know, you think of, they got back from the war, they're the greatest generation, whatever the fuck they were, but there are people that came back and was like, actually, I hate all of this. What if we just like did a shit ton of speed and banged randos? Like, actually, yeah, that sounds great. Let's all die by 40. But most of them lived surprisingly long.
I know. That's why fucking Social Security is going to go bankrupt any minute. So,
no, that's the boomer's fault.
Yeah, that is the boomer's
Damn
fault.
Damn it, Nate. Why are you still collecting it then?
That was Neil's fault because this guy was having kids with everything around town. So there's so many boomers.
So there's just fun stuff. The only other important thing I think that happens in this section is that he meets a hot Spanish mommy.
On the bus to L.A.
Did I send you this thing? I saw something amazing. Like, there's this Twitter account where it's just like ridiculous Reddit posts. And it was on the Mensa subreddit. Somebody wrote, oh, do people in Mensa like thick Latin mommies? and the moderator was like, I'm going to allow this. Most of the comments. Most of the comments lately are not related. I'm going to let this one go. So he meets a Mexican woman, and he's like, oh, you are hot. And she's like, all right.
She's 4'10". For a while.
That is a petite package. And they hang out, and they just want to just go bang and be a bum with me? And she's apparently down with that. And then they hang out for a while.
Well, she is escaping her abusive husband.
And her kid.
Yeah. Yeah. She gets him back. Yeah, then they spend 2 weeks while he becomes a fucking cotton-picking migrant laborer. Because, you know, they're just living day to day. And one day he's like...
But he's not good at it.
No, he's not good
hard.
At it.
He's hard. He's soft.
He has no practice.
He's a writer.
They're like, I'm only paying $3 for every 100 pounds of cotton. And he's like, now wait one cotton picking minute here. 100 pounds. He's like, I'll take it. And then he never makes more than like a dollar a day or $1.50 a day.
Yeah.
And he's
cotton doesn't weigh
it.
Very much, it turns out.
He's loving life, though. He's not, like, I feel like if I were telling this story of my life, it's like, and that was the time I picked cotton and my hands bled. And I lived on the fucking side of the road in a ditch, and I shit in a bucket. It wouldn't end with, and it was great.
Well,
that was my rock bottom.
A big part of this is like when he's at the beginning of the thing, at the beginning of the book, Dean is telling him, like, you know, you got to go on adventures, have experiences. If you want to be a writer, you have to experience things. If you don't know anything, how are you going to write anything? So he's like, yeah, sure. So he does. He goes like, I'm going to just try it all, do all this weird shit. Most of the stuff is getting drunk and doing speed and banging ladies and going to parties and destroying things. But it is experiences nonetheless. So he's like excited to try all these new things. And they do mention, you know, sometimes he's fucking miserable and he's hungry constantly because he never has enough food because of the speed. But also because he's fucking poor. He's also, when he's working, he is sending a lot of money back home to his aunt. So he's not like blowing it
all. I never understood where that money was coming from. Like
whenever he was in a place, he would stop and get a job. Because you could just do that. Like, I'm going to get a job for 3 weeks at a parking lot. And you would do it. And, you know, food for the day cost $1. So.
Yeah, anytime and there's multiple times in the book when he's like, oh, I only had $6. So I had 3 steak dinners.
Yeah. And I blew it all.
I had $4 left. Like, the price of stuff is crazy. It's like that scene in Half Baked. When he goes on the day, he's like, I only had $8. I had to make it last. You know what I'm talking about, Jimmy? I know Nate has not seen him. And he's like, oh, I bought he tries to take a girl on a date with $8. And there's like a tally in the corner of the screen. He's like, she's like, I'm hungry. What should we get? Like, how about a hot dog? But yeah, the price of things is crazy. There's times when he goes and gets, he's like, I was down to my last dollar. So I got breakfast.
It's like not even a hash brown anymore.
And he's like, I got eggs and bacon and sausages and hash browns and 7 coffees, and I still had 42 cents left. The price of food is hysterical in this book.
The price of everything is hysterical. Like later on when they're in Mexico, they spend like all day at a whorehouse for 3 people. It's like $36. It was like, wow.
$12 a man. Not bad at all. So he's sending the money back home. He meets the Mexican girl. They're like, let's meet in New York. He's like, yeah, that's probably not going to happen. And then they leave. And then he goes back home. Again. And he gets to New York. All sorts of adventures along the way. And he has absolutely no money in his pocket. He has to beg for money to get back to New Jersey. Is that where he lived?
He makes 10 salami sandwiches sitting in a toilet. And then takes a bus back to Pittsburgh and then goes to New York and then goes back out to Jersey where his aunt lives. And when he gets back, he buys her a lovely refrigerator with all the money that he sent back.
I highlighted that line because it was crazy.
The salami one?
Yeah. This is like the end of a chapter. It's like, I sat in the bathroom taking a shit, making salami sandwiches, and I loved it.
I made 10 sandwiches for the trip back to Pittsburgh, and I ate all of them by Indiana, and I was starving.
Is that the quote? Did you find it?
No, but that's basically what it was.
I mean, I was really repulsed by the idea of making sandwiches in a public bathroom. That was really upsetting to me.
It's like, where do you set it down?
I guess you're doing it on your lap, but it's really not cool.
On the edge of the sink?
How do you make 10 sandwiches with no table? Maybe with one of those like changing tables you pull down.
The koala care thing? Yeah. Okay, here it is. All around me were the noises of the crazy Gold Coast City, and this was my Hollywood career. This was my last night in Hollywood.
Oh, he had gone to Hollywood to try and sell one of his ideas as a movie, and of course, no one even listened to him. They didn't give a shit.
And I was spreading mustard on my lap in the back of a parking lot, John. Oh, God.
It's a porta potty. This is like this 40s equivalent of a porta potty.
You got to give him credit for thinking of the sandwich lubricant. It's like, I need these salami sandwiches to last a few days. I better put some mustard on them, too. Because, you know, a jar of mustard costs a nickel. So he was able to score one.
The mustard is a preservative. Because the sandwiches rot immediately.
Salami, I mean, I don't know. This is 1950s, well, 1940s salami. There was no pasteurizing happening. This was,
the salami smells rich.
Have you ever been into a Salamaria? the Italian delis?
That's the name of that Italian gay bar I've heard about.
Where they just have sausages hanging from the ceiling like trophy kills.
Yeah.
And you go and you're like, what is this thing?
That's Big Sal.
There was one where I grew up, the Italian deli, and everyone just called it, no matter who you were, it was just the smelly deli. That's what you called it. Because as soon as you walked in, like, wow, that's Jesus. What is that in the air?
there's a butcher on the corner right around here where I live, where the Greeks live.
Oh,
it's a very Greek butcher. There's like a whole lamb head and eyes still attached, hanging in the window usually. And my girlfriend went inside once to try and get like some meat, as you do from a butcher.
No one even acknowledged
her. They just stared, and they were all smoking cigarettes inside. Behind the counter.
That's how you smoke the meat.
That's how you cure it. What the fuck, yeah.
Formaldehyde cured.
Imagine that, like tobacco smoked meat. Sounds exotic.
So anyway, he gets back, buys a fridge, and then it jumps a year later. Dean reappears, and he's like, hey, I came to see you because I am a completely,
capricious?
Like just...
Impulsive?
Impulsive, that's the word. I was saying impetuous. Like, no, that's not the right word. Impulsive. So he comes, and he got his weird guy with him. And, he's got this dude, Ed, with him. And they had ditched his wife in New Orleans. And he was like, we just left her at a hotel. She was bumming us out. It's like, yeah. And she's a recurring character of just the lady who gets left behind by her husband and this shitty dude, Dean. But yeah, so he's gone on another adventure. He's like, hey, you've been in New York for a year now, like, doing some writing and all that jazz. Let's go on another adventure. And he's like, you know what? I actually do want to go on a fucking adventure.
So for the first section of the book, when I thought there might be a plot, I was like paying very close attention to all the things that happened. And then I was like, oh, there's no plot. There's no overarching plot. It's just a series of things that happen. And I was like, and then suddenly... I couldn't care anymore. Suddenly I was like, oh, more random things that happen? Okay, great. They weren't bad. It was just kind of like they ceased being important to me.
Yeah, most of the little things that happen are not important to any kind of plot because there is no plot. They're just like, these are the shit that happened when I did these things. Look at all the crazy shit that I saw out in the world. That, you know, just doing, going out, living life. So, you know, like, it doesn't make sense to recount all of them because there's no reason. There's no purpose. It's just odd things that happened because he was just trying to do adventures and get out because they didn't want to do the normal shit. And that's all it was.
It's like a longer, more pretentious version of that quote at the end of Blade Runner. It's like, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
It's kind of like that.
I've seen fire ships off of, you know, Alpha Centauri. And he's like, I saw a bum piss on himself in a truck. Like, holy shit, that's awesome. But that's all it is. So then they go on an adventure to drive around with, what's his name? Dean, who has bought a car. He started almost living a normal life. And he's like, fuck it, I'm buying a car.
Oh, right. They find him in Virginia, right? Because he's down in Virginia for like Christmas and they're like, they find him and they're trying to, and then they have to move furniture back and forth. It's like, I love driving. I'll just drive the furniture back and forth between New York and Virginia for free. And she's like, and it's like, yeah, fine, fuck it. And this is, you know, where you get a sense of Dean driving for the first time. And Dean likes to drive fast.
Breaks a speedometer. I don't know if it was right at this point or if it was later in the book,
Wile E. Coyote
literally breaks a speedometer because he drives too fast.
Yeah, because the thing he never does is slow down.
Oh, shit.
This is another cider from Artifact, but I think it's just a regular cider. No berries.
Yeah,
tastes like apples. How do you like these apples, some might say? These are fine.
Man, I was going to make that joke, too. I really need to spend less time together.
This is the only time we spend together.
I know. It's too much somehow. We should say that this, if you want to get insider DMs, you should go to patreon.com, so Drunk Guys Book Club, where our fine supporters support this podcast and help us pay for these beers. And keep that liver damage coming at a consistent rate every week. If you want to do that, you can get extra episodes and early access to stuff, join us for live episodes, and all sorts of other cool shit at patreon.com/drunkguysbookclub. Or you could help us out just by leaving us a review, a nice one. One for each part. This book is 5 parts. 5 stars. There you go. Or just tell someone to check it out. Like next time you're watching a bum piss on himself in the back of a truck, be like, hey man, when you're done, check out this podcast. Listen to it while you're, you know, on the road.
Yeah. So they have some adventures driving back and forth, and this is one of the shorter parts, or maybe it's not, I don't remember, because it's hard to, yeah, it's really hard to differentiate of them, but they drive around a lot, and he's like, you know what, let's go back west, because we've been here, so that's for, therefore we should not be here.
Because we're only 20% of the way through the book, and the book is called On the Road.
Gotta
so
spend a lot of time on the road.
Gotta go back on the road.
Is this when they go to Denver? They go back to San Francisco and then go to Denver? I can't ever remember.
They go to Chicago at one point, and then they're in San Francisco again for like
because that's where Dean nominally lives. Mm. I mean, it's a big hub of like the Beat Generation guys. They're all in San Francisco, so it's like a place where they all go to vibe and hang out and listen to jazz, which jazz is a frequent thing in this book because this is it takes he wrote it in the 50s. But it takes place in 47 through like 49. And this is like the bebop era of jazz when everybody is like super into it and everybody loves it, even if they don't really understand it.
Oh, God. This, you know what? I just want to drink another beer. I think, I don't know if they do it in here because this is when I started skimming, honestly. But they start, there is some marijuana in the book.
Oh, right? the tea?
Which, you know. If we're sanitizing it like they did throughout the rest of the book, it's like they had some special herbs, which you could now smell them on every street corner in Manhattan.
Not that special.
This is
also
special.
Buy them.
Yeah, it's like they haven't figured that out yet, have they? Like legally, no. Everyone's like, "Fuck it, who cares?"
All the pot shops are totally unlicensed, but the police are like, we don't want to bust them for anymore. We're tired of that. So they're just unlicensed.
White people own these now.
They have a storefront. It's different. It's not dudes selling it through handshakes.
It still is if you go inside.
Yeah, they still have to hand it to you that way. It's like how like in like Japanese culture, like they don't hand you the money. They put it down and you have to pick it up. Like you have to, yes. You have to hand the guy the money by giving slap dabbing him down. This beer is great, by the way. It's
what
special
is it?
Herbs El Dorado. I know you must. It must be on the list. This is from Two Villains Brewing. You know what? This is actually. Oh man! I, you know what, Nate? You think you won, but I might have. I might come close. Because you know who makes where this was produced? It's produced at the same facility. Of Two Roads, and they are often on multiple roads in this book.
They're on several roads.
Yeah, so
but only one at a time.
Well, except when they're like merging or taking an off ramp or something. So they go to California, but then they leave. And did that matter? No, it doesn't fucking matter.
Nothing matters.
And then they go. Then they go to Denver
again.
Again.
Is this when he gets there and Dean's hand is all bandaged because he broke his thumb punching his wife in the face, but he missed? And then he gets infected because they have to, because it healed wrong, so they had to do surgery to reset it right, but it was wrong again. It got infected and his thumb just rots away for the rest of the book.
Did that guy actually like lose a thumb in real life?
He was missing a chunk of it, at least, because they're like, he peeled back the bandage and everything underneath the nail was gone. It's like, oh my God. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, it's this time. And then they talk about lots of nonsense, but
it's because they're all fucking ripped on amphetamines.
And then I'm reading the summary. I don't remember what happens, Nate. Oh, it's my favorite part. It's when they meet the gentleman who they refer to by a title that we don't say anymore. They meet a gay guy. And I was like,
yeah,
nice.
They really do. And this is after they like edit out all the actual gay stuff that happens in the original version.
You have to tell us about
maybe
that.
It wasn't a slur. I mean, honestly, I don't remember it, like the details of it because I read it like a long time ago. But like even in this version, you can tell like he wants to fuck Dean. Like it's not subtle.
Dean has a magnetic cock and apparently butthole.
It has a gravitational pull, certainly. Surely due to mass. He is the Saloon Maria.
hanging sausage everywhere. And you're like, wow, have you been traveling a lot? That's, what is that?
Wow, that's...
Are those chives?
Is that a chorizo? Is that a, it's a soft cheese.
It's a chorissimo.
That should be the name of a beer. I think that would be a great name. So the guy wants to fuck him. No, then I don't care what happens. I just thought it was funny. Wow, that's cool. Some nice old-fashioned homophobic comments.
Yeah. Yeah, they go back and forth, meeting people, taking trips. And honestly, like there isn't a plot to get through because they just do trips and they go back and then they go to another place and they go to another place and they go to another place. And eventually he's like, what if we went to Italy? Sure, yeah, that's a great plan. But then they never go to Italy because they don't have any money. And because Dean has 11 children.
And he's also always talking about, like, is that bum my dad?
Yes. He is looking for his dad somewhat, but not really.
And that was one of the moments, like, is that the plot? Are we going to find Dean's dad? No, not really. Doesn't matter.
No, because he's not really looking for him. Dean is a whirling dervish of a human who is, in many respects, he's a real piece of shit. And like several times in the book, like Sal will get to a place and he's like, hey, where's Dean? He's like, we don't talk to him anymore. And I was like, oh, okay. And even by the end of this book, like Sal is like, I don't deal with that guy anymore. He's done too much. And it happened in real life. Like a guy pissed off so many people that people just sort of cut him out because he was a real shithead.
But what was he? Was he like, he'll fuck your wife kind of guy? Like what was...
Well, it's what he was like in this book. Like he fucked everything that moved, including people he shouldn't have. He was constantly just leeching off people for money, for drinks and for drugs, crashing with them. He was very selfish. Just like he existed only for like the immediate impulse of like, I must experience partying, but you know, for some grander purpose or whatever it was. But he was not someone that you could be around for a long time because he would just use you and toss you aside when you no longer had anything for him. And then he would come back a year later, be like, oh, it's kind of like he was like, you can't really diagnose people, but maybe he was like manic depressive or some shit. But it also could have just been he was on buttloads of speed.
It could have just been, this is also classic addict behavior.
Yes. I mean, they're all in some ways addicts, like drinking, drugs, just addicted to the lifestyle of nonconformity, you know, however, like air quotes you want to put that in, you know, thinking some of them really did believe that they were seeking some greater truth or like some new way to live because the old way was not working. Some people were just into it for the partying. So, you know, it's hard to know. It's also a big Venn diagram of those people. So it's hard to tell, but being around people like that, it wears you down. And, you know, he was a user of drugs and people.
But he could turn on the charm for a little while.
He was exceptionally charming. Like, you know, he's a grifter.
Well, he had, I mean, if you want to play armchair psychologist, he had to develop those kind of skills from his shitty, the real guy's shitty life as a kid, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
Making it on your own.
He was a, you know, it's a way to survive. It was a survival mechanism, certainly. But, you know, he did do this to everybody. And he died when he was like 40, 44 or something. He,
look out, Nate.
That was decades ago.
He was 41.
I'm way past that.
Yeah, he did a bunch of fucking drugs and died of exposure in Mexico, allegedly. No one knows how he actually died, but it was definitely drugs and being too fucked up related.
And nobody gave a fuck.
Yeah, by that point, he had, like, alienated everybody. He had, like, children with multiple women, all of whom hated him at that point, probably. And, like, even, you know, the people who used to really like him, like Jack Kerouac, were like, you know, that guy, he can't be around him all the time.
I remember reading this when I was trying to understand who Neil Cassady was. According to this is from Wikipedia, the physician who performed his autopsy wrote simply, quote, general congestion in all systems.
This shit's all fucked up.
It's all fucked up. But apparently it was like, yeah, he was a foreigner and drugs were involved. So we didn't want to complicate matters and have to get legal things involved. So like, yeah, he's just broken. He's a broken inside person, which he was.
Yeah. But it made him interesting, and it made for interesting adventures. You can't do it forever, but for a while, it's like, you know, everyone's got like a crazy friend that you like see once in a while. I was like, I can't be around that person all the time, but weird shit always happens when they're around, and it's exciting.
Memorable stuff, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, but that person lives that way all the time, and it's like, how are they still alive? Like, I don't know. They still exist.
Well, they're kind of like these vampires. They suck off of some person or group of people for a while to sustain it, and then they cycle to somewhere else. But if they last too long in any one spot, people are like, what the fuck? This isn't right.
So this book was really important. It was really famous.
Is there anything about how it ends before you get to that, Nate? Because that's an important thing you're going to say. But like, is there any other stuff we need? Because it ends when he's like, I think of Dean Moriarty as like the last line of the fucking book. Well, right?
It ends when, you know, after they go to Mexico and have adventures in Mexico, and then they go back. When they're in Mexico, Sal gets sick, and Dean abandons him.
Oh, Dean, like, also gets divorced in there at some point.
Well, he came to Mexico to get a divorce.
That was a thing, a Mexican divorce. It's also a song. It's like a Burt Bacharach song.
It's like a ZZ Top song or some shit. I don't know.
Oh, they have a Mexican cream pie or something. Oh, yeah. It's
different one.
ZZ Tops are far less subtle.
The sequel. But then
Gordito.
But then part five is like the shortest part. It's like just a few pages. It's like a while later, Dean shows up again. And by this point, Sal has moved on. He got married. He found a lady that's nice. And, you know, his roaming days are behind him. He's still, you know, in the scene, but he's not, like, apt to jump in a car and drive across the country yet again. And eventually, Dean's like, oh, I'll see you later. And then he marries another lady. And that night, abandons her to go drive back to San Francisco to be with a woman he had divorced while he was in Mexico. And then Sal's just like, yep, that motherfucker. Okay, well, I'm going to do my thing. And that's when at the end he's like, you know, I think of Dean, and also like the father we never found or whatever, which is his father, and also the one that died in the real version of the book, not the made-up divorce from his wife, which didn't happen. You know, he's done his adventures, and he lived things, and he experienced weird shit all over America and Mexico, and that's the end. There was no plot. There was no real thing. It was a little series of things that happened.
So now Nate's question is very...
Great. So, this book was very important when it came out.
Hold on, I have a beer for that, Nate.
This was a beer called Interrupting Nate from Finback.
It was extremely influential. I mean, Finback should have a beer called Interrupting Nate.
We can ask if they can do
why?
That. Because because your thumb is making a thumb.
Because you want us to interrupt you. It just gave a thumbs up thing.
I would literally, fuck this. Yeah, but now it's not going to do it, even though I'm like... Okay, so this book was a very influential in the 60s. I mean, it was finally published in like 1958 or something like that, or the early 60s.
57.
And then Hines, it really...
the year.
It is so, okay. All of the things that you think about when you think about the 60s counterculture. It's like San Francisco, drug use, free love, you know, and just, you know, let it all hang out. Just like let all your emotions, like Dean is all of those things. And like the stuff that happens and all the Americana and all this stuff, it is so reflective of everything in the 1960s or the 1960s counterculture. So much so that I don't even know if this book reflects the counterculture or the counterculture reflects this book.
Well, I mean, he wrote this in the 50s, but he's writing about stuff he did in the 40s. And this was like pre-hippies. Like the counterculture we think of is like generally hippies. But that's even 10 years later.
If you had changed the dates to like all this was 1967,
yeah,
you would go, oh, okay. Yeah, I see. It would fit in perfectly.
I mean, counterculture is going to always have some kind of commonality with other ones because the culture hasn't changed that much. And so the counterculture is always going to be somewhat related because it's just against the culture that exists. So I was going to be like, no, you know, not live a normal life. Go out and do things. Go out and experience the world. You know, it's definitely going to be similar. So I don't know. It's not, neither one is reflecting the other. It's just like that. That's what counterculture was in this era, and still kind of continues to be. It's not as extreme, maybe, but it still exists. Like, people still do this shit. It's just harder. You can't get a night job as a guard anymore without having a LinkedIn profile.
Not to be confused with my favorite techno rock group, Linkin Park.
I hate that.
Well, in the end, it doesn't really matter.
I mean, this book is still hugely important. It's like one of the great American literary things. I hesitate to call it a novel.
But fucking why? Why, though? I can understand why it's important. Like, oh, this captures a time. This captures a viewpoint. But like,
it's like a generational thing.
But like, no.
So the way it was written. Is it the way?
Well, like, what about that? Help me understand.
Okay,
that.
So you know, so Kerouac was at Columbia, and Ginsberg was at Columbia, and it was sort of just like post war and stuff like that, and you know, most like academic. It's sort of like a lot of the writing before this. It's very academic. It's very stuffy. You know, it is reflecting the, like, you know, Victorian novelists and stuff like that. But then these guys show up and they're like, we're going to write something that's real. And we're going to write stuff that is like real people doing real things. And it's vulgar and profane and all of these things. In a way, when you read the book, it feels like, oh, this is just a travelogue of crazy shit that happens. But then it is actually very carefully written to reflect like all of these things in a particular way of writing. But it's meant to be more like more real and not academic and, you know, fancy.
Like nowadays, this seems tame. But probably back then, you know, you weren't going to get a book about a guy pissing on himself in the back of a truck.
Yeah, wild back then. So different.
I get that. But like 5 minutes later from 1957, there are some really ridiculous things published. But not because
Electric
of this
Salmon Overture.
But like things are moving in that direction the whole 20. I mean, when was like Lolita published? That's from the 50s. You know, when was Clockwork Orange? Isn't that from the 50s or early 60s? Like, yeah, Lolita's 55. People were pushing the envelope after World War II.
Yeah, I mean, there's constant. No one book that's like, this is the book that changed everything. Nothing happens without greater context.
So I guess, why is this one remembered then, and the hundreds of other ones that also were, like, that's what I don't get, I guess. And I don't know those other books to compare them to, but like, if you hand this, like, this is one of those books I feel like that old people be like, oh, this book was important to me, or this book changed me.
It was important in the 60s. It was important for the counterculture, for the boomers who were, you know, young in 1967 and were reading this and were like, oh my God, this is so intense. And you know, and then like formed this whole like countercultural thing. So it was important for them. And that's why it's sort of remembered today. It just happened to be important then.
Yeah. I think it also still speaks to certain people. People that are maybe dissatisfied with the way things are. And, you know, they're not necessarily like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm a nonconformist. But like the idea of just like drop it and just leave, go somewhere, like, that's nice to some people. A lot of people, like, we are so fucking bogged down with shit we have to do. Like, it's a foreign concept. Just be like, fuck it, I'm going to drive to San Francisco and I'm going to go on an adventure. Like, oh, I got to see if I can get off of work. Like, it can be stifling.
Also, don't forget, he was like 25.
Yeah.
I mean, if all of this stuff really happened, like, he's in his mid-20s.
So when you would do shit like that. But even like today, people that age, they don't do that anymore. A lot of people, you know, you go to college and then you get a job and start buckling down. Maybe not that early all the time, but definitely by the time you're, you know, in your 30s. Yeah.
No, I get that.
Like, it's, if, you know, it's the call of the wild, but like the wild being just, the book is about, you know, not just like counterculture shit. It's about the freedom to do what you want to do.
I respect that. I just feel like what that freedom ends up looking like is being fucking impoverished, filthy, and desperate much of the book. And yeah, I don't know why. I mean,
there's
that's
certainly better ways to go about it, but
when he's like, I was making fucking mustard and salami sandwiches while I took a shit in the bathroom so I could eat them on the Greyhound bus that I could only afford to get to Pittsburgh or Philly or whatever it was. That's not romantic and that's like, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm the most conservative of us. I'm like, that's sad, dude.
Some people like the idea of that. Maybe they don't want to be poor. They don't want to, you know, eat a salami sandwich made in a toilet. But
I mean, that's the circle
some
of life
people,
right there. So it's where it's going to be soon enough.
It's the, you know, freedom versus security graph. Like, you know, everyone falls different parts on it. That's why that New Hampshire town's getting attacked by fucking bears.
Is that because all the women chose they'd rather be in the woods with a bear than
no, men? Because they decided they didn't want to pay for garbage pickup anymore. So there's so much garbage on the street that bears are coming into town to eat it.
Wait, I haven't actually heard this story.
Oh, yeah, you should look
it up.
I didn't
know that hairy gay men ate garbage.
Wait. What I mean is, what town is this?
And do I don't know what the name of it is, but if you look up New Hampshire Bear Attack Town, you'll find it.
I love to imagine a bunch of hairy, thick men roaming around wearing like leather daddy outfits in New Hampshire.
Leather daddies are a different thing.
I know.
But they're good for winter.
I'm putting it all together. And they're wearing, like, you know, Mr. Slave outfits. Just like, I like to be conquered from behind.
Okay, was this recently?
Did you find it? Yeah.
I don't know, last year. Well, okay, there's one article that says, How a New Hampshire Libertarian Utopia Was Foiled by Bears.
Yep, that's it.
That is our greatest weakness.
Bears. Bears also love the free market, it turns out. The free market is all picnic baskets.
It's picnic baskets. Yeah.
Okay.
They made a major boo-boo.
It's the freedom versus, you know, conformity / security / you know, what's expected of you thing. And yes, it is a harder life in almost every respect, but some people, they just can't fucking do the normal thing. And, you know, I get it. Like, certainly, I don't want to make a sandwich in a toilet, but, you know, it'd be nice to just be like, actually, fuck it. I just want to go somewhere. It can be stifling to be bogged down by society. And wanting to get away from that, I think that still speaks to people. Whether or not it's sustainable is unimportant. This is a living vicariously kind of thing.
But isn't it important?
No, you read books to escape, so you don't have to make a sandwich in a toilet.
But, like, to be like, hey, some people want to live a life like that. That life, by the way, parenthetically, is unsustainable and ridiculous, and they die homeless on a fucking railroad track in Mexico if they live that life. But, hey, man, you do you. I just feel like it's absurd. Like, and it's also fucking obnoxious when people, like, it's stifling to live in society. What a sad lack of imagination or sad lack of like appreciation for human endeavor that you're like, yeah, being married and having children or just enjoying these moments, like the things that I do on a daily basis.
Enjoying all the things civilization built for you?
I can't. That's not enough for me. I need to go fuck someone under a bridge in Denver.
I think this is the exact problem we always have is people saying, I don't want something, or something's not for me, is not the same as that's not a good thing.
I don't understand.
If I say I don't like that, what some people hear is then, you shouldn't like that either. But that's not...
This is exactly what we criticized Ted Kaczynski for. Whereas Ted Kaczynski is like, the best life is living out in the woods and killing a deer and occasionally mailing pipe bombs to people.
And we were like...
he thinks Industrial Revolution, you know, ruined everything because people aren't real men anymore.
And he thinks that everyone should be forced to live the way he wants them to.
I'm not saying that.
No, I'm not saying you're saying that, but I'm saying if someone says, this is not for me, I find it unappealing to live this way, is not saying everyone else shouldn't. It's saying it's not for me. If I want to make a sandwich in a toilet and die on a Mexican railroad track, that's me. But I'm not going to judge someone for like getting married and having kids and being happy. That's fine.
I agree with you on all that. I just feel like if you ask the character at the end of On the Road, how was all that?
Is he
going to say, it was fucking awesome? Or is he going to be like, yeah, that was a thing. That was crazy.
I think there's a mix, certainly. I mean, some of the adventures, he was clearly like, I had a great time. Someone was like, I wish I had something more to eat than cough drops for 3 days.
Yeah, right. There's the chat where he only has a Ludens or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, I mean, it helps, honestly, if you could plan a little better and if you weren't just fucking railing amphetamines for years at a time.
They made fun of him at the beginning of that section that his toes were sticking out through his shoes. I mean, he was like a comical Charlie Chaplin hobo.
Like a boot on his head with the sole off of it. Yeah.
And the most impressive thing is he was still pulling bitches. Like, I don't understand how you could go up to a woman with a homeless, goofy foot where your toes are sticking out of your shoe. I'm like, hey, do you want to go have sex behind that dumpster? They're like, well, yeah, fine.
You know, it's the life on the road.
That was impressive, honestly.
You gotta keep things interesting. It's a story that lady was like, yo, when I was on the bus from Saskatchewan, I banged a guy with a boot on his head. All the girls like, oh my God, that's crazy. What was it like?
Thurman
it was like,
Supreme?
It was real weird. I have to go to the clinic and get a shot right now, but I'll tell you about it when I get back.
Yes, he laid me down by the dumpster and I used his hobo bindle as a pillow. It made sweet homeless love for 3 minutes until his erection failed because he was just, he hadn't slept in 73 hours.
From the speed. Up on,
yeah. I'm not judging people. I mean, I am judging people. I think if you live this life, it's ridiculous. But the idea of being like, this is like, who
glorified?
Who are we advocating this for? This is fucking ridiculous.
I don't know if we're,
I mean, I know that in 1967 in San Francisco, when San Francisco was in the summer of love, when San Francisco was just overrun with hippies, with
runaway
drugged
teens.
Out hippies, with like, they didn't have food. They didn't have anything. Like, the city had to, like, you know, had to step in and, like, help them.
Well, now they work at tech companies, and they still can't afford food.
You go back and read, was it Life magazine? They had huge spreads on these just runaway homeless bum kids that they're all living like the opening scene of Free Willy, where they're squatting somewhere stealing a cake in the back of a truck.
I forgot to open specific. With homeless children, yeah.
Yeah.
You have to wonder, though, what were those kids running away from? Because it was the 60s. They probably got the shit beat out of them at home.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. Neil Cassidy, it would be almost 100. He was born in 1926. His life was fucked up and terrible, in his childhood at least. And then he made the rest of it fucked up and terrible by being a grifter leech.
A lot of people that do this don't do it because they were, you know, content or like not fucked up in some way, that they were trying to escape it by doing just the opposite.
Yeah, that's a very young person attitude.
Yeah, I mean, when you're 20, in your 20s, you're like, I'm going to go try some shit. Some are more extreme than others.
I get it. And I respect that to a degree, and that was never me. I was never that person. So I fully acknowledge that I am like, I was born a cranky old man.
You mean a libertarian?
Yeah.
Do you mean lover of freedom, Nate? Then yeah, I guess I am guilty of that.
And hating bears.
Well, no, I'm not homophobic. I don't, it's fine. But on the otter hand, Nate, I feel like you said it before, like, why do we glorify this? And that's kind of my question.
Like, yeah, the life, the like drifter life he led, why do we glorify
it? I don't know if we glorify the lifestyle. I think that as a, you know, cultural piece of art, this thing lives on as like a piece of history that is intractable from American society in that point. And it's still a good way to get a sense of what was going on then. I think the people that really like it now either see it as that or they get like, yeah, I get the feeling of, you know, wanting to get away. I don't think they're glorifying being a hobo, but they are saying maybe things could be different. Not this different. Not like this. Not at all. But, you know, I don't think anyone's reading this today and being like, I wanna do that. Or some people are. But the majority of people, no. It's a work of American history.
I do think there's an element of Kerouac's character who's fucking LARPing. Like, he's not poor. He's not desperate.
He's not rich.
He's choosing to do it, though, as opposed to the actual hobo guys who are like, I'm just looking for work. And he's like, this is a fun adventure.
The part of the generation that the Beat kids were doing this, like, you know, he wasn't rich, but he, you know, made money off, you know, his books, but he was really doing these things. And, you know, he would go home and live with his aunt, whatever, but these guys, for better or worse, really believed that, you know, society was doomed because of nukes, and what the fuck are we doing? There's got to be something different out there. Let's try other shit. It didn't really go anywhere. I mean, they didn't change America. But they provided a through line for, you know, whatever counterculture shit was going on. You know, they didn't become the hippies, but like the hippies took up the, we're the counterculture now shit. But I mean, I don't know. It's hard to, it's impossible to really say how they changed anything because shit just happened. I don't think that they, you know, they didn't make any wins in Congress, certainly. But, you know, they were just trying new shit.
This reminded me of Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, definitely.
Whatever that book was. But yet that was 20 years later. Yeah, Fear and Loathing. That was 20 years later. This was a slightly more tame version of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Just like 10% less, more tame.
That's because he took different drugs than that one.
Yeah.
This was just uppers. You know, taking the hallucinogens, that'll really fuck your shit up. Did you guys know that acid was made in 1945? I thought it was way later than that.
We fought the war to liberate it. I thought there was a whole bunch of shit was like only discovered in the 40s, like acid, steroids,
like the good stuff.
The good, yeah, the American drugs.
I mean, this is also the Beat thing. Like the whole generation was like science. What we thought of, you know, was going to save us all, has instead doomed us all. So like that's not the answer either. Because we're all going to die, because any minute we're all going to get nuked. It was a legitimate fear at the time. So they figured, you know, what if we just gave up this, you know, and just, you know, became cotton pickers for a week?
I'll give them way more credit, honestly, than the doomsaying 23-year-olds today who glue themselves to the fucking highway. Going out on the road and having sex behind a dumpster, way cooler.
Well, I think the throwing a can of soup at a painting is a protest. More than
it is, but they're like, oh, this world is ruined and you fucked it up. And these people are like, let's go out and do drugs and fuck. I respect that a lot more than the people like, I'm going to make a statement about late stage capitalism. Fuck you. Go fuck behind a dumpster like Jack Kerouac. That's, you know what? I changed my whole opinion. That's way better. It's fucking way better.
Wow. I don't even know how to articulate that change. It's like, you're so crotchety that. You now agree with the old hippies?
I'll agree with the old crotchety people, the people who are older than the
people who would shit on people. This generation of crust punks.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, I'll take that, honestly. That's far more than I thought I'd get out of you.
Well, just because the difference in this ridiculous scenario that we're setting up here, that the people who complain and like do these stupid performative protests, it's stupid. It's like really dumb. Whereas the guy's like, I'm going to go live a fucking other life. I'm going to go live on the road. and panhandle and pick cotton for $3 a week to live that life. That takes balls. I respect that way more than the people who go on the, you know, the I'm going to go live at my fucking trust fund, like the stereotypical that type of person. I got to give Kerouac credit for that. That he was like, yeah, I got my degree from Columbia. Now I'm going to go become a hobo. That does take balls of a sort.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely not faking it.
I never want to read a fucking other book of his in my life, but, you know, really not interested. But here's the test. Nate, you can only want to be fair because you were there. But what would you read? would you want to read any other Kerouac?
I mean, are they just like this? Because I don't need to read more of this.
From what I know, they're not like... I mean, I don't know if he wrote like novels. I'm not really
I know
sure,
he has one book called The Dharma Bums.
Dharma Bums, the yeah. Dharm. That's, you know, that's similar to this. He also has... But he also has characters that are real... These real because he has another character called something else in one of his later books that's just Neil again. So, like, they're all based on shit he did. I don't know if there's any, like, straight-up fake novels. I'm not 100% sure. This is the only thing of his I've ever read, and I didn't look into anything else.
Holy shit. Do you know his real name is Jean-Louis? He's French-Canadian.
Oh, that makes sense.
Or a French-Canadian ancestry. He's Kerouac. In Lowell, Mass. Jean-Louis Lebris de Kerouac. Whatever the fuck that is.
There you go.
He was raised in a French-speaking home in Lowell, Massachusetts.
That does make
sense.
I knew
there was something wrong about him. So who should read the book, Nate?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, if you want just a story about crazy adventures, then yeah, sure. Go ahead and read it. But do you need to read it? No.
I'd agree. Jimmy, what do you think? You liked it? You
I made love us this see book. This? I don't think it's for everyone, though. And I'm not going to try and convince anybody that it's worth reading. Like, it's either like Jimmy. Your thing or it's not, but I love it.
I just feel like for several generations now, old people have looked at young people like, you should read this book. It was important. And it's kind of dumb to do that because it's not for everybody.
No. And I don't think any, for lack of a better word, conservative old people have ever said, you should read this book.
Well, no, you have to know what the enemy is thinking.
This is why I don't pick up hitchhikers, because they do this shit.
These goddamn commies are up to.
It's a character named Carlo Marx, for God's sake, and that's white Christian God's sake.
All right, tell us what you thought. Send us an email to drunkguysbookclub@gmail.com.
Follow us on Twitter at drunkguysbc.
Or go to Facebook and or Instagram at drunkguysbookclub.
Head over to patreon.com to support the podcast, or just leave us a review, or just tell people to listen to it whenever you see them on the road.
And go to Goodreads and tell people to listen to us there, even though they already know that's because that's where they are to talk to us, because we talk to people.
And check out the Hopped Up Network, a network of independent beer podcasters. And thanks for listening.